Appreciate Bill's words just there about the Word of God. I think we'll find this morning some of the things that God had to say a very long time ago have a lot of practical application for us still today. The genesis for my thoughts in my sermon this morning came maybe even now a few months back when I read an article online that said, "You're doing your weekend wrong." And it had a lot to say about modern-day weekends, modern-day concepts of weekends and all. And as I read through it, I thought it had some interesting applications for us, potentially spiritually. And I want to read a few just small snippets from that article real quick to kick off this sermon. And just a quick comment: this is a secular article with no biblical or spiritual intent or application. But I think that even makes their findings all the more interesting, that their own scientific research and observation has landed in the same place I believe God, we will find this morning, landed as well. But a few quotes real quick. It says, "Positive psychologists advise that the path toward fulfillment lies in leisure of a different and higher order. According to University of Calgary sociologist Robert Stebbins, most leisure falls into two categories, casual and serious. Casual leisure pursuits are short-lived, immediately gratifying and often passive. They include activities like drinking, online shopping, and the aforementioned binge-watching. These diversions provide instant hedonic pleasure. In a culture where many people exist all week in an amped-up, overworked state, casual weekend leisure easily becomes the default for quick decompression. Instead, the weekend goal should be eudaimonic. You practice that 300 times and you still can't nail it. Happiness, which is a sense of well-being that arises from meaningful, challenging activities that cause you to grow as a person. This means spending the weekend on serious leisure activities that require regular refinement of skills. Finishing rebuilding the Jeep, learning to play guitar or some new song, your baseball card collecting, or some other in-depth projects." In his famous essay, In Praise of Idleness, published in 1932, I particularly found this interesting. This is a long time ago that these observations were made compared to our modern-day pace. Bertrand Russell bemoaned the quality of leisure time in an increasingly mechanized world. "There was formerly a capacity for lightheartedness and play, which has been to some extent inhibited by the cult of efficiency." I like that term. I'm going to refer back to that a couple of times. "The pleasures of urban populations have become mainly passive, seeing cinemas, watching football matches, listening to the radio, and so on. This results from the fact that their active energies are fully taken up with work. If they had more leisure, they would again enjoy pleasures in which they took an active part." Russell couldn't have imagined just how thick the ranks of the cult of efficiency would become. "Devices keep us tethered to our workplaces at night and on weekends. Our offices are in our pockets and our purses. The concept of quote-unquote free time becomes obsolete or looks like failure when every second can be monetized. In a live-to-work society where your career is also your identity and your status, the instinct for leisure and productive rest atrophies. We need to be as vigilant about the quality of our free time as we are about the quality of our work." Pretty insightful quotes, I thought, for someone who had no particular spiritual intention with this, these observations, and particularly the insightful quotes from a few decades ago. Their conclusions were they find it more beneficial to do some of these things: to socialize, to cultivate healthy and deeper relationships, particularly with family and friends. Find a hobby, something that challenges the brain, learning, to read, and allow someone to get into a state of flow, or as we may say, get in the zone. Altruism, be about serving other people, be busy doing things for others. And then for play, enjoy time that is healthy for you physically and mentally, and brings you joy. My notes on this particular thing are much larger than mine at home, and I can't see them all. So anyway, I thought this was particularly interesting, that for an under-the-sun observation, I read through this and thought, yeah, I've noticed a lot of that as well, and I feel like I've heard some of these principles before. And in fact, I think we'll see this morning, God foresaw a lot of these same needs for humankind and for mankind. So this morning, I thought it would be good if we spent a little bit of time talking about the Sabbath and then eventually some applications from the Sabbath for us today. But first, before we can do that, we kind of need to dive into what the Sabbath was originally, where it originated, and what its original intent was. Obviously, some people say today that Sunday is the Sabbath. Or some people still believe that Saturday is the Sabbath. But I think we'll see this morning that Sabbath is something different altogether than a specific day. Even in the Old Testament, it is about rest from your labor, but it is even more than that. So let's just dive in. And what I'm going to do now is just, we're not going to turn to these, even in your iPad. You probably won't have time to turn to these quickly. But I'm just going to inundate you with a volume of verses and also how each one kind of has its own take on the Sabbath and the benefit of the Sabbath, as well as the why behind the Sabbath instruction. That's so important, right? When we read the Old Testament in particular, to understand the spirit behind the instruction, or the spirit behind the discipline. So, of course, it starts in Genesis chapter 2, verse 2, where it says, "And God rested." That word there in the Hebrew is Shabbat, or Shabbat. Some of you may be familiar with it. I'd forgotten about that. That word literally means to rest from labor. So the implication right out of the gate, right, is that physical rest, that element of it, has a benefit to it. Not only for us, but we see God modeling that for us right out of the gate. In Exodus chapter 16, verses 22 to 35, something I had never realized before, God actually institutes the Sabbath before He gives the Ten Commandments. The discipline of Sabbath is started before He gives, a few chapters later, the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20. This is our first introduction to this discipline. It's when they are coming out of Egypt and they are still kind of homeless, if you will. And God promises to them that He will give them manna every single day and a double portion on the sixth day, so that on the seventh day they can rest from their labor. And He does this every week for 40 years, 2,000 miracles. And it shows He already has a concern, even though they're not an affluent society yet, even though they don't even have a home, He is concerned with their potential for overwork and for being consumed with consumption. And it's just very interesting that He already tries to let them know that physical rest is very important. And one of the reasons why He states is, "I want you to know that you can trust Me to do without for one day, to not work for one day. So I'll give you twice as much on the sixth day." And in fact, the very first time, the very first Saturday that comes for this, they start to go out and look for manna. And God gets mad and said, "Why didn't you trust Me? I told you, don't worry about that. I'll give you double the day before, and then the next week we'll do this again and again." In Exodus chapter 20, we actually have the fourth commandment, which is where, again, there is an appeal to the creation model of rest. He says, "I want you to keep the Sabbath day holy, because God Himself rested on the seventh day and saw that need to step away from His work. So how much more then would we as God's people need to do that in this day and time?" So it's interesting about that particular passage. This is now not a new concept. This is now something they have already been doing for some period of time. And so He says, "That thing I've been having you do, I want you to do that forever. That's now part of My law." In Exodus chapter 31, we kind of see and hear a few more terms that we don't see in the other passages. And we see here, more than any of the other previous passages, just how serious God took this particular command. He again says that it is holy, but He says if you do not adhere to this discipline, it is punishable by exile or by death. This is no trivial matter to Jehovah with God's people. Okay? Here we have the phrase complete rest. It's as if, again, He's trying to emphasize the serious matter. This is not something I want you to kind of do, mostly do, or almost do. I want complete rest from My people on the seventh day. He says also this is to be a perpetual covenant. This is not something for a short period of time, just for right now, until you guys get into the land, the promised land, and you have all these things you can consume, then go for it. It's not a matter of saving up, right, because they don't have much yet. It's more fundamental than that. And I hope you see, as we're going through this, we're not talking about the particulars of the command, of the instruction itself, but the benefit and the why behind it. He believes here, in this particular passage, he says God was refreshed, implication being you need to be refreshed physically, mentally, spiritually, refreshed, restored, recentered. Deuteronomy chapter 5, we have now a slightly different why behind the need for the Sabbath All the previous ones, for the most part, appealed to God resting at creation and some other benefits. Here, he appeals to the fact that he just brought them out of slavery from Egypt. What's his point there? Well, you were just living a life that was a slave to your labor. You work all the time. And that was miserable, right? So part of what the Sabbath was meant to do was to remind them the benefit from the rest of a life of labor. What I've brought you out of. How many times do we see in the New Testament and the Old Testament, God or Jesus or the apostles appeal to his people to say, God has brought you out of a certain condition to live a new and different and sanctified way. Do not go back to that. If anything, find gratitude in the fact that you can rest now and remember that. Don't be a slave to your work like you were in Egypt. In Leviticus chapter 23, we have a new sort of angle on all of this. What's interesting here is he talks about these being the Sabbath being a holy convocation. So I'm like, all right, I don't say convocation every day. What does that mean? Yeah, all that really means is a sacred assembly. The Sabbath itself was meant to be something more ecclesia-like. A gathering of people or something done collectively as a group. And so there's a communal element that was supposed to be a part of the Sabbath. All of God's children were to share in this discipline together. Not independently, but together. And part of what he wanted God's people to be, right, were a unique people that were set apart. Well, how much more unique would this nation be if everybody together is participating in this same discipline of resting from their labors, trusting that God will provide, I don't have to work today, and other nations would see this nation collectively participating in this together. That would set them apart from the, not just the, just in generally speaking, but also from the economic ways of all the other nations. The following verses in Leviticus chapter 3, there's even more sacred assemblies that have to do with Sabbaths. When I was reading some of the initial text, God later on in the Old Testament, you know, condemns his people for not, you know, adhering to all of his Sabbaths, plural. I was like, I need to go remind myself of all the things that were Sabbaths. So in my study, I was reminded the Sabbath, of course, was not just Saturday. That's not the only day, the only discipline he asked his people to stop and to rest. Verse 4 is when he says, and there's more sacred assemblies, basically. Verses 6 through 8, the first and seventh day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread were to be sacred assemblies, and you shall not do any laborious work, he says. There's a physical rest element and benefit there, again, as part of the first and the seventh day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Verses 11 and then 15 through 16, we see that the Sabbath day, I mean, we know this, but this is a reminder, was very much a part of their worship. As they brought all their sacrifices from their harvest, right, what they've consumed and worked for, as well as their animals, which they've maintained and built up. And it's interesting how much of this instruction about rest in this particular chapter is within the same context of all of their sacrifice. And so you have two things together that would foster a trust that God will provide. That there are these other days that I don't need to work. It's okay. I don't have to keep consuming. I don't have to keep working. And in fact, I want you to give back some of what you've already worked for and maintained and give that to God and, of course, other offerings were beneficial for other people around them. And so it was an encouragement that you can do without and not to be so self-consumed. In the seventh month, in verse 23, they were to blow the trumpets and have a rest on the first day as well. So there's more days throughout the year beyond just the seventh day that they were supposed to stop and rest and get out of the grind, if you will. In the midst of all of this, remember, these are all instructions as they are about to enter the Promised Land, which was not a barren land, right? That's what made the land so amazing, is that it was a land that was very blessed. And they were about to be a very affluent nation. So you have all this instruction about sacred assemblies and worship and sacrifices, all within this context about going into a land of plenty and a land of much and a land of promise. And within all that, he says, make sure you don't consume at all. When you reap the harvest of your land, he says, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor gather the gleaning of your harvest. You are to leave them for the needy and the alien. And so we see here a little bit of God trying to make sure they don't have a cult of efficiency or consumption, even back thousands of years ago, as he asked them to not consume at all and to leave it for others, not to be self-consumed. We'll see this a lot in the New Testament. Leviticus chapter 16. There's more to come. We're getting through these, but hang tight for a minute. Leviticus chapter 16. This is where we have the Day of Atonement. I think most of us probably are familiar with or remember the Day of Atonement. Obviously, this was about sacrifice and forgiveness of our sins. But the Day of Atonement was also to be, quote unquote, a Sabbath of solemn rest. In this case, you have the word solemn. So there's this idea of reflecting, right, upon our sin, because it was the Day of Atonement, and our relationship with God. It is to foster the humility, the humbleness that we are all to have, a poor in spirit, you know, disposition. And he saw the Day of Atonement as a day to do that. It was also about complete rest. And he says in that passage, so that you may be humbled, to humble your souls. And again, within this passage, we see the seriousness of it all. He says, if you don't adhere to this, you will be cut off or you will be destroyed. And so even within the Day of Atonement, there was to be rest. And the benefit here is humility, poor in spirit. Also, I didn't say this, but it was also a sacred assembly. Ezekiel chapter 20, and all of these verses, he actually speaks to two different generations who had lived in the wilderness who had not kept his Sabbaths, the parents and the children. He said, this was to be a sign between me and you. One from creation, from what he had rested, that you could trust me, but also to the other nations. There's a sign element to this, that they may know that it is God who sanctifies them and sets them apart. And he says, in this particular passage, he showed compassion and mercy to these people, particularly in the wilderness, where the implication being, you can't blame them for working a little bit more because they didn't have much to begin with. So there's some grace extended by God. However, he says he was really angry about it all because he sees children who are not grateful and trusting in what he had already done for them. They are already consumed in a non-affluent society, wandering in the wilderness. They are consumed with work, even in the wilderness. In Leviticus chapter 25, I had forgotten about this as well, but there was to be a Sabbath for the land. I think most of y'all may remember this. Leviticus chapter 25 refers to this. Every 7 years, he says, look, the land needs a break. Don't farm it into the ground. This actually happened with a little bit of research. In America, with our cotton fields in the south, particularly in South Carolina, where some of those fields were ground into the ground, and they had to be kind of given a Sabbath for some time to kind of get their feet back underneath them. The land itself even needs to be replenished. The land itself really itself needs to be refreshed and restored. It wasn't to be run into the ground. And he says, again, all this is about trust. God even assures that he will provide 3 years' worth of harvest in the sixth year. He says in verses 20 and 21 later in that chapter, so that maybe they will trust. If they don't do anything to the land for a year, maybe they'll trust that he will still provide and everything will be okay. So he gives them 3 years' worth. He doesn't want it to be a culture consumed with productivity and consumption. Another reason he probably would have given them 3 years' worth is because in the year of Jubilee, something we don't talk about a whole lot, this is also part of Leviticus chapter 25. In this same section, there was to be a rest as well. Now, in this particular case, it deals largely with land, property, and property rights, if you recall, including people, maybe even as property and slaves, though the text isn't super clear about that. But it was about returning the land to those who had to sell it for whatever reason, out of money, couldn't make do, that sort of thing. And that land was to be returned to their family, whether the actual individual who had sold that land initially or an heir to that land, the land was to be returned to them. He says, and this year, the year of Jubilee, was to be treated as a sabbatical year. But this year would have been the 50th year, if you read through the text, which means every 7 years they were to give the land a rest. And then that means the 49th year would have been a land of rest. And then the 50th year would have been a land of rest. So again, he's asking these people to trust him. And we see in the spirit here of this kind of Sabbath rest was a rest for all these individuals to return back to their family and to be released, the captives. The context immediately following all of this is actually about the rich not being so consumed and so selfish that they don't return to the poor that which they may have already bought from them. So some people may have been like, no, I've been taking care of this land for 50 years. This is my land now. And there's an encouragement from God to say, no, release that. You give that back to whom originally had it. You let go of that and trust me and give back to other people. And then finally, in Isaiah 58, we see that Sabbath was a matter of honoring God. Verses 13 through 14. It is because of the Sabbath you turn your foot from doing your own pleasure on my holy day and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy day of the Lord honorable, and honor it, desisting from your own ways, from seeking your own pleasure, and speaking your own word. Then you will take delight in the Lord. And so, what's the why and what's the benefit here? Again, to reinforce here, it teaches us not to be so self-involved. In fact, he says, the Sabbath was not me time. It was not to be something that was also to be something to be endured, or to be a slog, which Jesus also addresses a lot. It was to be a delight. So, in summary, the Sabbath was not to be a time for doing nothing. Interestingly enough, there was a lot that happened on the Sabbath day. But it was a time of rest from our own interests and their own pursuits. And to properly pursue a deeper sense of relationship with God, a deeper sense of gratitude for what God had already done for them, all the sacrifices that He had done for them to give sacrifices back to Him, an awareness of and serving other people, right? And doing so alongside the rest of God's people collectively, together. It was a holy discipline that deepened their trust in God. You might even say that the Sabbath was made for man, and man was not made for the Sabbath. Which brings us to the New Testament, and we can't really go through this study, I don't think, and draw practical modern-day applications from an Old Testament discipline, unless we have to see what Jesus has to say about it. According to the Gospel accounts, Jesus healed more people on the Sabbath than any other day of the week, at least according to the accounts. He taught and He preached on the Sabbath, and He even proved from over and over from Scripture that He was not violating the Sabbath, because He knew the intent and the spirit behind the Sabbath. And what I want us to see is that what He did do was He emphasized it and He modeled it. He modeled proper behavior on the Sabbath. What the day was truly for, He wasn't just listing all the things you're not supposed to do on the Sabbath. He modeled it. Starting in Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 through 17. This is where we come in. We're familiar with the story of the disciples picking grain in the fields. And of course, they're rebuked for that. What's interesting about that, when Jesus counters them with the story of David, he says, come on, you already see a pattern where this behavior would be okay. Part of his point was, why was it okay for David? Because what David was doing is he was actually resting from his labor. His labor was to be a soldier and a king. They were taking a break. They were taking a break from it all to eat and just to refresh themselves so that they could do their job and do it well for the Lord. And this is where Christ appeals to the quote, I desire compassion or mercy and not sacrifice, which we read a few times in the Old Testament, reiterating to these people that it was about the spirit and the heart of that instruction, the benefits and the why, which we tried to list out just a few minutes ago, than the actual instruction itself. And it's in this passage where he says the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Verses 9 through 14, he's in the synagogue. He asked them, different gospel accounts say it differently, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And part of what he's doing is when he makes the point that if one of your own sheep or ox or whatever, we see this particular story play out four or five different instances, were to fall into a pit on the Sabbath, you would take care of it. But if it's somebody else, well, then that's different. It's against the rules. And his point was condemnation of their hypocrisy, that they were self-consumed about the Sabbath. Again, if it was an issue that pertained to them, then it was cool. They could go get their ox out of the pit, right? But if it had to do with somebody else, then it was an issue. And his main point is they were so self-consumed on the Sabbath that, as we've already read, the Sabbath was not about being self-absorbed and about consumption. It was to be about other people. In 15 through 16, it says, many people follow him, and he healed them all. Lots of healings happen on the Sabbath. And Mark, we see some similar stories. And we're 21 through 28, he casts out the unclean spirit. 29 through 31, he heals Peter's mother-in-law. 32 through 33, late in the day, the people began bringing to him all who were ill and demon-possessed, and the whole city gathered at the door, and he healed them all. All of this is happening on the Sabbath day. On the Sabbath. This is the kind of work, this is the kind of behavior and leisure, if you will, that Jesus was involved in on the Sabbath day. It's about other people, you see, in all these verses. It's about healing and restoration with all these examples. Chapter 6, 1 through 6, he heals the sick. What I found interesting is in Mark 15, verses 42 through 46, when Joseph of Arimathea comes to get Jesus' body, and later in John, we also learn that Nicodemus comes with him as well. He comes around the evening time on Friday, because he himself was getting ready to prepare for the Sabbath. And so he comes and gets Jesus' body, and they put him in the tomb on the evening, as the Sabbath was beginning on Friday evening, and lay Jesus to rest. And the one full day that Jesus actually has in the tomb, resting, is on the Sabbath day. On that Saturday, he is raised the next day on a Sunday. We have other passages that show us that Jesus went down to Sheol. There's a lot more we could say about that, but I just found it really interesting that it is Jesus himself is laid to rest by Joseph as the Sabbath is starting. In Luke chapter 4, Jesus uses the Sabbath day when they are there to worship to proclaim his ministry, to kick off what his ministry would be about, and that is sharing the good news to the afflicted and the brokenhearted, serving others and providing rest and restoration and healing for those people. Specifically, he says, I'm proclaiming liberty to captives and freedom to prisoners. Proclaim the favorable year of the Lord. Does that sound familiar? The year of Jubilee. Nearly identical language that we see with the year of Jubilee, which was a Sabbath year. And Jesus appeals to that, connecting his ministry, his behavior with that. In Luke 13, he again points out the same stuff about how they were consumed about their self, and they would not have made an exception for others. And in this case, this lady was doubled over. And he says, should she not have been released from this bond on the Sabbath day, this lady that he healed? In other words, isn't this what the Sabbath is all about? Providing rest and healing and restoration for people like this? This is what the Sabbath is all about. In Luke 14, he again says, if your ox were to fall into a well, would you not immediately go do something about it? Of course you would. Because you understand the basics of it, and the reason why you have issues with it is your self-absorption. It is not about self-absorption. And then in John, there's a couple more healings in chapter 5 and chapter 9. And in fact, what I found, and I double-checked this, every single mention of the Sabbath in the New Testament, excuse me, within the Gospels in Jesus, he heals on that day. In every single instance of the Sabbath, Jesus heals on that day. It is about restoration and healing. And in most cases, he's also worshiping. His focus is on God. His teaching is about the Word. It is this recentering back on the Lord. In Colossians chapter 2, Paul condemns a few people who have turned the Sabbath and holy days into a self-made religion and a fleshly indulgence. My only point there I want to call out on that particular verse is that fleshly indulgence is the very thing that Sabbath was intended to mitigate. And he says, and these people are using it for that very thing. It's a misuse and a misunderstanding of Sabbath. It's not about self-indulgence. Hebrews chapter 4, verses 1 through 11. We who have believed, enter that rest. This is an appeal to Jesus and the foreshadowing, the shadow that Sabbath rest was to be. He fixed a certain day, today, not just Saturday or Sunday, to be a rest in Jesus. There remains a Sabbath rest. There remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. So yes, the Sabbath isn't what it once was under the law of Moses. I think, I hope nobody misunderstands this morning that my conclusion is on Saturdays we need to change all of our worship and all the things that we're doing. Not at all. So it's not what it once was under the law of Moses. But also, I find it very interesting as we read through all the benefits in the Old Testament and then specifically read through what Jesus had to say about it, or more specifically, what he didn't have to say about it, that he never renounced the Sabbath. In fact, he participated in it, and he modeled it for us. He sought and taught to all the people around them to reorient them about its original intent. And these weren't just verbal corrections. Again, he was trying to model the behavior. He saw the Sabbath as a blessing for them. It was a time of worship, community, teaching, healing, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, restoration. And it was about not to be about being self-involved. We are clearly to find our rest in Jesus today. So therefore, if it has ongoing value, my question would be, how do we quote-unquote Sabbath today that is in line with its original intent, the original principles and fundamentals of all that? Well, I believe that the modern Sabbath, from my conclusions about all this, and there are people, scholars who have studied this, you know, their whole lives probably. I know 10,000 times more than I do about all this. This is just from my own curiosities. But it does seem that if we were to Sabbath today in our own way, it would be about dedicating a time to focus on what I have instead of searching for something new, more consumption. It's a time to disconnect from work and technology in order to reconnect and be present, right, with our family and our friends and our church family, and to not to be about ourselves. It's a time to be grateful. So much about all this was a reminder of what God had done for them, and that's why they can stop for a minute and reflect on what God had done for them. It was also an intentional effort to turn off and to tune in for all these people. As a result of our busy lives today, we don't reflect on ourselves, our life, and others around us many times. We don't recenter our minds and hearts on God. We don't read and meditate on His Scripture like we are supposed to. That's part of the reason why the elders give us our daily Bible reading. That's part of the reason why we reflect on it at the beginning of services. We often don't look to serve and provide rest for others like we should. Our hearts drift away from a foundation of humility and gratefulness. We aren't even resting our minds as much as we think because we fill it with worldliness as a sedative of our frantic spirits. The cult of efficiency, I believe, is what we're caught up in today. As secular, again, as that article might have been, he was pretty accurate, and that feeds all of our self-absorption. Technology, which is great, but unfortunate, it has made it very easier, so much easier, to feed our desire for instant gratification, to numb our emotions, and that to be our Sabbath that distracts us from anxieties and maybe even from work. And the problem, though, is it's allowed us to avoid some sort of holy discipline with the Lord. Social media, television, 24-hour news coverage, all of this gives us an easy outlet and a distraction. Instead of praying to God, turning to Scripture, spending time with our church family, togetherness, collectiveness about it. Our coping mechanism is often our 50-inch TV, not the kind of things that God had asked us to do to take a rest from our work. What's ironic, I was telling Amy, is that computers, modems, cable boxes, all those things, you know what you have to do to those things from time to time? You have to unplug them. Otherwise, they stop working. And if they aren't working very well, when you've ever called in for technical support and they say, unplug it, and they say, make sure you leave it unplugged for like 30 seconds. Why do they tell you that? So that the whole thing powers down entirely, a complete rest. So that when you get ready to power it back up and it's time to get back at our work, it's now fully functioning, right? And also, interestingly enough, if we just leave, and we probably do, leave this computer plugged in at all times, it'll actually deteriorate the functional utility of this particular battery in a computer. If it stays plugged in at all times, you think, well, I'm just got it plugged in, it's good to go. But if you leave it plugged in at all times, eventually it won't last as long as it did when you first bought it, because it breaks down. And it's pretty interesting. The Scriptures say Sabbath is about a complete rest, and it says we are to meditate on these things. And it's no surprise, as we read through all this and we even look at our own lives, why God had them carve out these times weekly, monthly, yearly, and even 50 years. And there's no evidence that they even ever did, from the Scriptures, participate in the year of Jubilee. If they did, there's no record of it. So after studying this, I tend to think that Christians need to practice some form of Sabbath. I'm not here to tell specifics or what that means or whatever. But I think we can see it's there in the Scriptures. With some sort of Sabbath and discipline or practice, we will probably devolve into this same behavior he feared for his people, consumed by our own labor and our busyness of life. No, the Sabbath isn't what it once was in the law of Moses. I acknowledge that it was born out of specific circumstances for a specific people, pertained to a specific period of time. It was part of a larger law for a specific region of the world. It had a lot of specifics to those people. All of those things were a foreshadowing of Jesus. Right? And we see that in the New Testament. More passages I didn't have time to go into today. And I appreciate your patience with the ones I did go into. But all these were foreshadowing of our rest in Jesus. However, I think most of us tend to acknowledge that the Ten Commandments were a moral law. And that all of them, except for one, we tend to talk about, of its ongoing application. That the Sabbath itself is a part of that, and therefore, as such, being a moral law, it has ongoing implications as well. So to me, our takeaways are this, and I'll leave you with a parable. And that is, let's try to slow down in our lives. Just have a discipline, whatever it may be. I don't have a list of options. I read a few different people's ideas or whatever. I think Jeremy and his family do a great job of this at night. Have a reading they do with their children. When they get around the Bible, around the dinner table, the kind of Bible study that they do. They've made that a regular discipline in their lives to stop whatever they're doing in their day and to read God's Word, to pray to Him, to look one another in the eye, and to spend time with one another. I don't know what this means for us as a church, but I think part of a worship service like this is a part of this, and there's probably other things we could do that have the same benefits. So we can recharge, so we can recapture a deep gratitude for what God has done for us. So we can spend that time, not about me time, not just binge watching in front of Netflix, but seeking how we can make a sacrifice for other people and for God. That's also part of what Sabbath is. We are to avoid self-absorption, consumption, and under-worship, and to recenter our hearts on God. I couldn't help but think about this verse in Psalm 46, verse 10. He says, "Be still," or in other versions it says, "Cease striving and know that I am God." If there's one verse that captures, I think, a lot of what we've talked about today, is the benefits of ceasing from our work and our striving and consumption and self-absorption, and know that He is God and He will provide. There's one parable I want to read here at the end. It is not a biblical parable, but it's one that someone shared with me recently, and I couldn't help but connect it to this particular lesson. It's the parable of the Mexican fisherman. I don't know if anybody's ever heard this before. It's a common parable. But it goes like this. An American investment banker was at the pier of a small coastal Mexican village when a small boat with just one fisherman docked. Inside the small boat were several large yellowfin tuna. The American complimented the Mexican on the quality of his fish and asked how long it took to catch them. The Mexican replied, "Oh, only a little while." The American then asked, "Why didn't he stay out longer and catch even more fish?" The Mexican said he had enough to support his family's immediate needs. The American then asked, "Well, what do you do with the rest of your time?" The Mexican fisherman said, "I sleep late, I fish a little, I play with my children, I take siestas with my wife, Maria, I stroll into the village each evening, or I sip some tea, play guitar with my amigos. I have a full and busy life," is what he said. The American scoffed and he said, "I am a Harvard MBA and could help you. You should spend more time fishing and with the proceeds buy a bigger boat. And with the proceeds from the bigger boat, you could buy several boats. Eventually, you would have a fleet of fishing boats. Instead of selling your catch to a middleman where you would sell directly, to the processor, eventually opening up your own cannery. You would control the product, the processing, and the distribution. You would need to leave this small coastal fishing village and move to Mexico City. Then we'd probably go to L.A. and eventually New York City, where you would run your expanding enterprise." Mexican fisherman asked, "But how long will all this take?" To which the American replied, 15 to 20 years. What then?" Asked the Mexican. The American laughed and he said, "Well, that's the best part. When the time is right, and you would announce an IPO and sell your company stock to the public and become very rich, you would make millions." The fisherman, "Millions?" He said, "Then what?" The American said, "Well, then you would retire. You'd move to a small coastal fishing village where you would sleep late, fish a little, play with your kids, take siestas with your wife, stroll to the village in the evenings where you could drink your tea, play guitar with your amigos." I thought that was a particularly poignant parable. And hearing some of the chuckles, I hope the point is fairly evident. And I hope some of the practical applications from the Sabbath has been fairly evident for all of us today. You know, like I said, I don't have a lot of specific things we ought to be doing on an ongoing basis, but I couldn't help when I read that article to go dig in a little bit to see if there were any practical applications for us today, even if it's not a Saturday or a Sunday. So I hope this has been beneficial for you. If you're not a Christian, what I hope you see from today, and if you continue with your studies and be a part of a group like this, is the benefits of being in Christ. The benefits of having a life with other people who have the same foundational beliefs, system, and disciplines as you. People that can help you with what you're trying to accomplish, not only in this world, but spiritually in the world and God's kingdom. If there's anything we can do for you today to turn your life to Christ, to devote yourself to Him, and build your own disciplines, whatever they may be, in a spiritual nature, please come as we stand and as we sing.